when I first decided to do a YouTube video, it took me weeks to record the first one. I'll never forget it. I was sitting on the sofa before I was going to come into the office and record. I was almost in tears. I was so in my head about it. And part of it was I felt like I had to be a different person, a different personality. And just like shifting my office around and getting the adjustable desk so I can stand up, like even that, I feel more relaxed and that I can be myself. I got this headset so I could talk to you because I talk with my hands, as you've probably noticed. Being myself helps me relax, and I think helps my videos flow better and just, again, go back to that authentic personality that this is who I am. And if you don't like it, great. If you do, great. Come back and you know, keep watching.
Well, hey, everyone. Welcome to episode 366 of F-Stop, Collaborate, and Listen with your host, Matt Payne. This week on the podcast, I'm excited to bring you a conversation that I had with someone that I am honored to call a friend, Michael Rung. Michael and I first met virtually at an Out of Chicago Live conference, and for whatever reason, we just hit it off. It has been a real joy watching him grow as a photographer and battling the challenges that come with pursuing photography full-time, something that we talk at length at today. Before we dive into today's episode, though, I want to give a quick shout-out to Heather, my guest Michael Rung's partner, owner and designer at Star Street Creative. As some of you may know, Heather is the designer of the Click Click Baby F-Stop Collaborate and Listen t-shirt, and I'm excited to announce that I've got something really big in the works with her. She's currently working on a top secret project that I can't wait to unveil in the coming months. Trust me, it's gonna be really cool. Whether you need a sleek new website, eye-catching branding, or stunning graphic design, Heather at Star Street Creative has you covered. So if you're looking to take your visual presence to the next level, look no further than Star Street Creative. Check her out online to see how she can elevate your brand to new heights. You can find her at starstreetcreative.com. All right, let's get to this week's episode with Michael Rung.
All right, Michael Rung, it's great to have you on the podcast, finally.
Thanks for finally getting me on here, Matt. Yeah, as you can see, I came prepared.
I was going to say, for people that are just listening, they don't get to fully appreciate the t-shirt that you're wearing. Maybe you could just describe that real quick.
It's you, baby. I can't remember. This was what you made this for, a Patreon thing. Thank you to your members, your supporters. But my wonderful partner Heather designed a Matt Payne F-Stop Collaborate shirt. So I got big old stylized Matt Payne on it saying, click, click, baby.
And of course, it's like, it's a picture of me with Vanilla Ice's hair.
Yep.
Which is pretty clever.
You never look better, Matt.
That's probably true. I don't think I've ever had hair that looks that good.
I've never seen you with hair, so.
Yeah, it's been a long time. All right, Michael. Well, for people who don't know about you and your photography, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm Michael Rung, obviously. I'm based out of North Texas in Fort Worth. I've been here, this April will be 12 years since I moved from St. Louis, which is where I spent most of the rest of my life, or in about the St. Louis area. I am an aspiring, or attempting to be an aspiring full-time photographer right now for the last couple of years, which I know we've got some plans to talk about that a little bit. You know, I've been quote-unquote into photography for almost 10 years from like a serious standpoint. Prior to that, I was one of those window phone nerds that was all about the Nokia Lumia lines with their fancy cameras, and that's kind of what got me into photography, both moving from Texas but also getting that phone. I was taking the Windows phone out to the local park and exploring the new homeland and playing around with the camera and thinking I was so cool, taking shots of my car and grass and trees and stuff. And of course, it's all awful, but it was a business trip over to Ireland back in 2015. I was there for 2 weeks, and therefore I had a free weekend to myself, and I was right on the coast, on the east coast, not too far from Dublin. And one day I just spent the entire day walking from the town I was staying in to the next one up along the coastline and then walking back. And then the next day I did a bus tour to Northern Ireland up to Giant's Causeway and some other areas. And again, all I had with me was the Windows phone. I don't even know if I had a point and shoot at the time. And, you know, getting back home, it was the first time I'd really looked at nature photos or landscape photos I'd taken and thinking like, wow, these are actually pretty good. And like, I threw them into Lightroom, had no idea what I was doing, and, you know, did a whole bunch of garish editing and everything. But that was what spurred me to go out and buy my first DSLR. I got a Canon T5i. Again, still had no idea what I was doing for like 18 to 24 months and couldn't figure out aperture and ISO and you know, all that stuff. And then it clicked and kind of just, and again, I know we'll talk about it, but you know, I kind of went from the plan and having all these expectations to a more reactive style. And that's when I really feel like my work improved. I became a happier photographer. And the rest, as they say, is kind of history. As I mentioned, I've been making a go of it, trying to make a go of it full-time for the last couple of years. And we can talk plenty about this as we get further into this little interview here.
I love it.
I forgot to mention before I get in trouble, I have a partner, Heather. As I mentioned, she helped design the shirt, or did design the shirt from scratch. We don't have any kids, but we do have 6 furry kids, which is a lot. So 6. Our house is perpetually covered in fur, and we've got a Roomba that you know, lasts for like 2 years before they croak. So, but yeah, 6. 2 dogs and 4 kitty cats. We're a blended family, so, you know.
Wow. I have 4 cats also. So
I didn't know you had that many. I just thought you had a couple.
4.
So you're not too far off.
Not too far. Yeah, a little less chaotic than you probably, but
there's always some kind of chaos going on.
Well, when we first met, you were working for GameStop, and you mm-hmm. were spending all of your vacation time traveling the country, trying to do photography workshops, going to out of Chicago conferences, things like that. I know you've since quit your job, which was sort of like a quit slash downsize thing that happened to you. And I know you're, like you said, you're trying your hardest to do photography full time. How's it been going?
I mean, just, you know, full disclosure, it's been a challenge, but there's a lot of mitigating factors in that. You know, as far as the background, yeah, when we first met virtually, I was in a role that I really loved and enjoyed. That's what sent me overseas for some projects we were initiating or implementing. And then in 2019, there was a huge corporate restructuring, and that position had actually been eliminated. Fortunately, at the time, they offered me a completely different position, completely different department, and something I really had no background in. But I decided that was better than no job at all. So I accepted that offer, and it ended up just not being anywhere near what it was described to me. And then for anybody that's familiar with GameStop, of course, there's been a lot of turmoil, for lack of a better way to put it, with the stock and new leadership coming in. And kind of within the span of like 6 months, the company culture just really did a complete 180, especially in the corporate side. I had spent 17 years out in the retail side, both as a store employee and then as a district manager. But the corporate side especially, I think, just really things changed a lot with new leadership coming in. And there was what seemed like a lack of respect for those of us that had been around a long, long time. I'd been there for, at that point, 25 years or so. And yeah, so the new job wasn't what I expected, and things kind of came to a head finally in late 2021, and I left the organization at the end of January of 2022. So I've been trying to make a go of it since then. And again, being honest, like, this all kind of happened sooner than what I had really kind of had in my mind. This was something I'd been thinking for a few years at least, like, you know, could I at some point feel comfortable enough to make a go of it with photography full time? In my mind, it was always, I'll spend the next 3 to 5 years trying to build up the business and kind of at least have one foot in the door. I think I was still kind of like walking up to the door when I ended up leaving the organization. So I didn't have the starting point that I really envisioned when I did end up leaving the corporate world. When that all came to a head, though, I decided, just from a mental standpoint, I was going through some health struggles, which again, I know we'll probably get into, but I wasn't really in a place to go seek out another corporate job. I was a little bit disillusioned and whatever you want to call it. So I decided, well, what better time than now? I'm probably going through a little bit of a midlife crisis as well, which I think I'm mostly past at this point. But yeah, it's been an interesting ride. So I didn't start this journey, so to speak, in any way, shape, or form in terms of how I anticipated doing so or had kind of loosely planned to do so. So a lot of that first year especially felt like me trying to just catch up from being behind the eight ball. And as I'm sure you can attest to, that's not easy, even with what you're doing now. You know, before we started the recording, like you were saying, like so much of what you try to do doesn't pan out, or, you know, doesn't end up generating any sales or revenue or what have you. So it's been a huge learning experience. Lots of emotional ups and downs and the whole thing. And just the shift from a corporate world, you know, again, I worked for the company by the time I left for almost 27 years, and suddenly I'm self-employed. That alone is a huge, huge shift. You know, kind of having to do everything from scratch yourself as opposed to having the overarching company mission or, you know, what have you. So, it was a lot of adjustments. There's been a lot of times where I feel like I've gained traction and like, okay, I've taken the next step and things are going to start moving, and then it all slows down again. I feel kind of like way right now. I feel like, you know, I'm right on that cusp of maybe taking a next step or two, but who knows? That could very well go 6 months and, you know, be out on the street with a hat asking for change. So. Not really.
I was going to ask you, like, how are you putting food on the table without a full-time job?
Yeah, so I do have a part-time job, actually through Heather, a former client of hers, was looking for somebody to part-time manage an office, little small office, kind of complex office park. They were losing their community manager that they had. And, you know, it wasn't anything like I was chomping at the bit to do, but I figured, well, you know, when your income is like this, and those peaks especially aren't very high when you start out and it's up and down, a part-time job can help flatten out those rough patches a little bit. And it's not anything I can live off of or anything like that, but it supplements the savings I've been relying on. And then I do have income coming in through the photography, just not anywhere near what I would like and hope to see. But going back to the GameStop thing, like, for years, it had been obvious that there were some very rough waters ahead for the company. You know, they were in an environment where you're selling physical goods that are basically all being sold online now or digitally downloaded, and there's only so much that could be done to counter that. And, you know, part of the new leadership coming in was, oh, we're going to be the next Amazon or this and that and same-day delivery and blah, 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 but that's a hard curve to make. So I'd been setting money aside for quite a while, both, again, thinking like long-term, yes, I think I would like to make a go of it with photography and knowing I would need a safety net, and ended up being shorter term. But again, fortunately, at least I was already in the process of kind of building that safety net for myself. So relied heavily on that, still relying on that to an extent. So yeah, again, like if anybody wants an unvarnished look at what it's like to try to start out, like, it's not the easiest. Maybe I've made missteps or mistakes, or, you know, it'll never happen for me or whatever. I'm realistic enough to realize that, but it's certainly not something that I could have just jumped into without having that extra cash set aside that I had for whether I ended up leaving the company or the company laid me off. You know, corporate workforce, I think, is like 40% of what it used to be, or the company went belly up. So, you know, fortunately, all of those things kind of aligned to, quote unquote, force my hand into making sure I had some extra savings set aside. And now I'm watching it all go up in smoke.
Well, you could always try out OnlyFans, I guess, but I'm not sure that's going to work out either.
I'm told I have a nice butt, but that's all for Heather to talk about.
All right, well, I feel like we can take this a lot of different directions based on what you just said, but I want to kind of drill a little bit deeper into the whole corporate thing. Like you said, you spent over 20 years in the corporate environment. How did that corporate upbringing help you or perhaps hinder you in terms of how you've pursued full-time photography?
So I would say in my mind, I envisioned it helping me more than what it probably has. you know, some very obvious things, and a lot of this isn't even necessarily when I was in the corporate office, but more when I was on the retail side. You know, I spent, again, 17 odd years or so in customer service and sales and training and development and coaching. I was actually a certified trainer, both for store managers, you know, regionally in that, as well as other district managers. So I went through certification for training and coaching and developing others. And I think that especially is where, with my YouTube channel, hopefully, you know, you can see the outcomes of that past experience in terms of my teaching style and how I'm able to break things down into very easy, understandable steps, methodologies, what have you. I think that's probably been the single biggest benefit of my background that I've gotten. Where I would say the biggest, not negative, but just surprise has come from is the sales side. And again, I think part of it was just an overly optimistic expectation of like what I could do with print sales, but also coming from a world where I wasn't having to go out and convince somebody to buy a video game when I worked in a store or when I was a district manager and had multiple store teams under me. You know, you had people walking through the door actively, hey, I want this or I want that. And okay, here you go. And the, you know, maybe the most you had to do is add something on, or you had that occasional customer that didn't know what they want. And, you know, you just had to know the product and sell it to them. Selling art is really, really different, it turns out. So, I mean, I think interpersonal skills and relationship skills and things like that aren't directly sales related necessarily, but I do still have that understanding of that background. But, you know, there's very little face-to-face interaction in this. You know, I'm trying to sell. I'm not doing art fairs or anything like that, so I'm trying to sell solely online. So how do I build that personal connection with somebody that I'm used to relying upon from a sales standpoint? So I think that's probably been the biggest surprise, is how that hasn't translated as well as I thought it would. On the flip side, like I said, you know, relationship management, I worked with a ton of different personalities, you know, especially as a district manager. I was managing a bunch of people anywhere from, you know, their late teens into their 40s, and, you know, all around different parts of states and the Midwest and that, and really having to understand those personalities and how to work with each individual one on a one-to-one basis and everything. But with customers as well, you know, you don't treat every single customer as the same type of person, because they're not. And again, that's where I think that difficulty in building those personal relationships kind of hurts. Time management, I think, is a skill that I came into this that has helped me, but it's also, ironically enough, I think I looked a lot of it, and this goes into that transition from a more structured working for a company piece to working for yourself. A lot of times I came into it, especially early on, of like, well, I'm not working in a corporate environment, so I'm just going to go with the flow and do what I want and, you know, kind of keep it loosey-goosey, and realize that, oh, wow, you know what, to-do lists are actually helpful. And, you know, I've got post-it notes lining the closet door in my office here of, you know, kind of the big projects I want to work on and where they're at in terms of progress, if, you know, they've been started or in progress or finished or whatever. So I'm learning to lean into a little bit more of that experience too, instead of just kind of spinning around each morning and going, oh, I'm going to work on that. Because I did, like, especially the first probably year, really. I think you and I even talked about this after you left your job. Like, you wake up in the morning and you find yourself going, well, what am I going to do today? Like, I need to do something, but what is it? So that's where I'm getting back into a bit more personal organization and planning and goal setting and to-do list and all that good stuff to keep myself on track a little bit more, because there's just so much that goes into it. It's very easy to get focused on, hey, I need to do these three things, and that's my focus, but you forget about bookkeeping and, you know, email you got to answer to, and it's just, there's so many different things. You're wearing so many different hats, which, again, I think my retail background helped a lot with, because, like, when I was a store manager, I was loss prevention, I was human resources, I was, you know, managing some of the accounting to an extent in terms of, you know, store numbers and things and, you know, cash management, all that stuff. So you wear a lot of different hats. I'm used to that, but it's just something I think I probably didn't realize really what it's like to to work for yourself and be the one person responsible for it all. So it's definitely been an adjustment.
What would you say is holding you back from finding ultimate success? I mean, I think about, you know, you mentioned print sales, and not to toot my own horn, but I feel like I have print sales fairly dialed in, and there's no way I could rely on that income to feed my family. So I think that's, you know, like I've said it before, but I think it's, you know, you have to have like 100 tentacles. And but what's holding you back? What do you think's...
I think a big part of it is just my audience size, quite frankly. And, you know, not to get on to the whole let's bash social media, but that environment is very, very different from what it was 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. So whereas in the past, it may have been easy for me to get 10, 15, 20,000 followers. I don't know, but probably easier than it is today where, you know, you're scratching and clawing for just, you know, one new follower and there's a 50-50 chance it's a scammer or a bot or, you know, somebody trying to sell or buy NFTs to scam you. So audience size is a biggie, and that's something, especially in 2023, I tried to put a lot of focus into was how do I rely less on social media and more on my website from an SEO standpoint, search engine optimization, help people find me without having to be reliant on social media solely, but also working to get more people signed up for my email list. Because again, you're kind of, then you're bypassing all the algorithms and everything. And even email is not 100%. You know, as we all know, stuff goes to spam. Or if you're like me, my personal Gmail is a total mess and I can go weeks before I scroll back down and see something. So nothing's foolproof. But I think, like I said, for me, the biggest thing is audience. YouTube, fortunately, has been fairly successful for me. It's by far my biggest audience. It's twice as big as, in terms of followers or subscribers as anything else I have. But it's also a very different audience. And I think, and again, I've talked to you about it, but I framed my YouTube channel very much Lightroom-centric, as anybody that knows me knows, around tutorials and quick tips and things like that, which is all well and good. And, you know, that led to a nice partnership with Adobe when they launched Lightroom Masking and things like that that I never really thought I would have an opportunity to do. But I've also... And maybe this is just me being paranoid, but I've felt like it has kind of shoehorned that audience into thinking of me as the Lightroom guy and less so thinking of me as it relates to my photography work. I am taking steps to shift that a little bit. And I know looking at my YouTube analytics, I've lost a fair bit of followers, but I'm also gaining a bunch of different followers. So, yeah, the audience piece of it. And then I think... And it's tough coming out of the corporate world into this full-time photography life. I was behind the eight ball because I wasn't prepared the way I should have been or would have liked to have been. So I would have liked, if I could go back in time and obviously knew then what I knew what was coming, having a business plan laid out in terms of, okay, these are the pillars I want to focus on and how am I going to drive these and that. And I probably have plenty of opportunity to improve that still today. But I've at least got a better idea of, you know, building multiple revenue streams. Because like you said, you can't rely on just one or two. And like we saw with the pandemic with photographers that were entirely or very largely reliant upon in-field workshops, you know, you never know when one of those things is just going to go poof and go away, either short-term or long-term as technology changes or what have you. So it's a little bit of throwing spaghetti at a wall. And again, I probably still need to be a little bit more structured about it, but at the same time, I think at this point, I've got a fairly good idea of where I want to be. It's just how do I get there? And I still think that the audience is the biggest piece. Cause, you know, if you convert 1% of people into sales at my audience size, that still ain't much. So how do you reach a bigger audience? And again, build those personal relationships going back to the sales side, whether it's trying to sell workshops or prints or, you know, getting people to subscribe to my YouTube channel. It's all kind of sales. So I think relationship building with a, I hate to say a consumer audience, because I don't want to just look at people that follow me as solely consumers. I'd like to think of them a little bit more differently than that. I don't know even what to term it. But anyways, like, how do I build that relationship with them so that they know more about me and who I am and my values, and both from a photography standpoint and just life and that too.
It is interesting though, if you think about, like, if you're trying to grow an audience and you're previously known as the Lightroom dude, but you want to grow an audience that's more into your vlog or more into buying prints, those are potentially very likely very different audiences. And so... Yeah. It's almost like you have to start from scratch and reimagine how to reach those people in a different way. And if I knew the answer to that, I would probably just bottle it and sell it. So I think it's different right. for everybody, right?
Well, you know? And it's interesting too, since I've been putting out, I know we haven't really touched on like specifics of YouTube a whole lot, but you know, of late I've been focusing on doing some in-field videos, which less than a year ago I put out a video saying I wasn't going to do that, ironically, and here I am like six videos into it.
That's funny.
Like I said, I've definitely lost subscribers, but I know, or I suspect, that the subscribers I'm gaining are a different audience from just solely the Lightroom stuff. And I'm going to still do the Lightroom stuff. Like, I'm going to kind of do what I want to do. And that's the thing where I've probably held myself back from YouTube. And this is one of the things I talked in the video last April about. I mean, I'm not going to do in video. I'm not going to do weekly. I probably could have grown that audience quicker if I had followed more of the cliched YouTube approach, but that would make me miserable. So anyways, what it comes down to is, like, looking at demographics on YouTube, typically my viewers have been mostly like 55 plus, but as I've been doing these in-field videos and releasing them, suddenly I'm seeing a big spike in like 25 to 35 age range, which is interesting. But it also kind of meshes, because a lot of them are, you know, whether it's overlanding or car camping or backpacking or whatever, like, it's kind of a similar crossover, I think. You know, whether that equates to them becoming clients or customers or whatever down the road, who knows? But I am seeing a shift in the demographics as I've been doing these videos. So it's been kind of interesting to see that too. I just got to find, I think, a way to keep both audiences happy without alienating one or the other.
And I mean, that's
we'll see how that goes. But
I feel like in YouTube, the way to do that is to just do playlists, you know, and then use hashtags. Yeah. So, like, it differentiates your audience that way, but
right.
I don't know, man. I'm certainly no YouTube expert. I read a lot about it, but I'm just, like, every time I try something, I'm like, well, that didn't work. Oh, well. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, but even there, I mean, it's so hard with YouTube, because what didn't work, quote unquote, when you released it, or even the first 6 months of the first year it was out, it could suddenly blow up. And again, not to keep referring to conversations you and I have had, but we were just talking about that yesterday with, like, I did the 4Runner walkthrough of my camping setup for the 4Runner, and all of a sudden the last 2 weeks, like, it's just gone through the roof for some reason. It hardly did anything the first, when I released that almost 6 months ago, I want to say. So it's hard to gauge, because you never know when it could be just topical and timeliness, seasonality of the year, and maybe this is the time of year people are looking for that more, as they're wanting to get back out and camping and exploring and stuff. And when I released the video, it just wasn't the time for it. There's so much that goes into it. It's definitely an interesting game.
Well, speaking of the game, you know, one thing that I didn't really have in my notes here, but I think it's relevant to the conversation we're having, is talking a little bit about authenticity in YouTube and mm-hmm. content creation. And you just said I could, you know, play the game, but I would be miserable. And that's one thing that I've seen a lot of people gravitate towards, is like clickbait titles and mm-hmm. flashy thumbnails that are, you know, not even what the video is about. Maybe you would talk a little bit about your thoughts on that particular subject.
Yeah, I've definitely leaned away from the clickbaitiness or misdirection or what have you. I feel like it may not benefit me the most short term, but long term, I think I'm building a better foundation for my audience to have trust in me and realize that I am authentic and not just out to get views and, you know, stir controversy with hot takes or, you know, whatever crazy BS is going on out there. And it's interesting, actually, I just watched, ironically, a YouTube video yesterday, but it was somebody saying, like, we're starting to see a shift in the YouTube quote-unquote style and what viewers are looking for, like this whole, you know, quick cut and in-your-face editing and sound effects and special effects and, you know, kind of that Peter McKinnon style or whatever you want to call it, Mr. Beast. We're starting to see potentially a shift away from that to a more relaxed, authentic, quote-unquote raw or uncut kind of feeling, which is not how I've approached, like, with my Lightroom stuff, since it's tutorial-based, like, I want those to be very well presented and professional and, you know, good audio, good video, the whole bit. Whereas with the in-field stuff, like, so far I'm just recording it with my iPhone and I'm not scripted. I'm just talking off the cuff and sharing my experiences and talking through my day or the shot I'm setting up or whatever, but I'm not doing all this B-roll and, you know, added drama or coming up with some crazy scripted idea that I can make it look really intense or crazy or whatever. And I think long term, I think/hope that that will build a more loyal, engaged audience than me going out there and trying to be somebody I'm not. And also, like, I'm a very, if I don't know you, I'm very introverted. I can be very, very shy. I always have been. And like going back to when I first decided to do a YouTube video, it took me weeks to record the first one. And like, I'll never forget it. I was sitting on the sofa before I was going to come into the office and record. And like, I was almost in tears. I was so like, I was so in my head about it. And part of it was, I felt like I had to be kind of a different person, a different personality. And, you know, just like shifting my office around and getting the adjustable desk so I can stand up, like even that, I feel more relaxed and that I can be myself. I got this headset so I could talk to you because I talk with my hands, as you've probably noticed. Being myself helps me relax and I think helps my videos flow better and just, again, go back to that authentic personality that this is who I am. And if you don't like it, great. If you do, great. Come back and you know, keep watching. But if I try to fake it, man, that's when I'm just like so stiff and awkward. If I'm too scripted out on a tutorial, even these days, I can't get through it. I know the subject matter. I just got to talk and go with the flow and let it happen.
I'm the same way. I just have to talk and hope it comes out right.
Yeah. Well, you know? As an example, like I tried to record some infield stuff several years ago. And I had notes written down and, okay, I'm going to cover this and this and this. And it was the most stilted, awkward, like it was painful to watch. Like a couple of them I edited, I was like, there's just no way. Like self-consciousness aside, like this is bad. Like I look like a robot trying to be funny or, you know, whatever. And again, it was not authentic. It wasn't natural in any way, shape or form. But with these videos I've done locally in the fall, and then this video series I'm putting out right now from my fall trip to Utah, like it's just all off the cuff. And, you know, maybe it's a little rough, but that's the whole point. Like, that's what it was. So,
well, I happen to know from watching your YouTube videos that your approach, similar to your approach to making YouTube videos, your approach to making photographs has shifted quite a bit since you started taking images. What has changed in your approach to photography and why?
Yeah, so I've been looking forward to this question. Like I said, 2017 is kind of when I hit my stride, and I felt like I mostly knew what I was doing with the camera and how to, you know, use the different functions and everything. And that was the first year I did any kind of astrophotography. I think it was in March of 2017, there was the Dallas Photography Club set up a get-together at a place in Central Texas called Fort Griffin, which is a dark sky spot. That's the first time I'd seen the Milky Way, certainly the first time I'd ever photographed it and like seeing it on the back of the camera. Like I think just about everybody experiences just like mind-blowing. So I'd already, by that point, I think even before I bought my camera, I think I was aware of Michael Shane Bloom and Sean Parker, both from their time-lapse work, but also their astro work. And once I saw that Milky Way on the back of my screen, I was like, that's it. I want to be the next Shane Bloom or whatever. And I went down the rabbit hole, not as much in the astro stuff as I thought I was going to, but just in general, I went down the rabbit hole of planning. You know, I got to have all the apps. I got to have photo pills. I got to have a sunset predictor and obsess over these things. And again, the video you alluded to, like, talked about this, but I just made myself so miserable because I would only go out and shoot if I thought the conditions would be fantastic. If I went out and they weren't, I would basically get mad and angry and frustrated and just shut down and not even take my camera out and go home. Conversely, if I was out with Heather or her and her family or, you know, what have you, and there was a sunset kicking off and it was just fantastic, I would get mad then because I wasn't out shooting it. So as much as I still love a great astrophotography shot and sunset and sunrise shot, like I don't pursue those anymore. Honestly, astrophotography is kind of like, I can take it or leave it at this point in terms of me doing it. It just feels like it's been done and there's little left to surprise you with. But by the end of 2017, I'd realized I really need to change something because I was just burning myself out on photography. I wasn't enjoying it. It was becoming the antithesis of everything that I had hoped to get out of it, which for me is, again, I think like a lot of people, mindfulness and peace and calm and the joy of being out in nature, which is really hard to do when you're pissed off because you didn't get a banger sunset or whatever. So I actually set a goal for myself to not shoot a sunset, not shoot a sunrise for, I think I set it for an entire year. And I might have the years off here. It might have been 2016, 2017. But regardless, like going back in my files, I think in that next year, I only have 5 photos that even have the sky in them, which is a complete 180 from, before all my photos were reliant upon having a great sky. It wasn't about a great composition. It was about having a killer sky and just something in the foreground or, in the landscape to ground it or whatever. So, I did that 180. I also started focusing a little bit more on slowing down, but not really until 2019. 2019 and especially going into 2020, I was telling myself, I really want to approach my photography more as a film photographer. Really take the time to observe and be thoughtful about the composition before I set up the tripod so I'm not setting it down and growing roots as the photographer trope goes so often of you set it down and then you never move. But even like going into 2020 when I first met you at the Outer Yosemite conference, before I left for that conference, I would, in my quiet moments, I would sit and visualize not like, oh, what am I going to do if I'm a tunnel view and I've got a killer sunset? Like, that's quote unquote easy, but what am I going to do if I'm there and it's blue skies the entire week? And just kind of visualizing, like, I didn't know anything about Yosemite other than, what everybody knows about Yosemite. I'd never been there. I didn't know what it was like to explore the trails or anything like that, but what would I do? Okay, well, I might look for, woodland or trees, just whatever, little details and things like that. So it was really the first time I visualized something other than building it up to, I've got to have these great conditions and have these high expectations to, what am I going to do if everything falls apart and it's blue skies all week or, what have you. And that was really kind of that realization and that slowing down, I think, was really where I took the biggest step forward. Like I look at my work prior to 2019, where I started emphasizing slowing down and being more thoughtful, and then 2019 and beyond, and it's almost like there's a hard line between the quality of my work, at least in my eyes. So I think letting go of those expectations, going with the flow, I talk about them in blogs and in the videos and everything, but I consider myself a reactive photographer now, and I know there's quite a few people that are using that terminology. It's, I think, somewhat of the not buzzword or whatever for photography right now, but I think it's good that more people are talking about that. Like, you don't have to be 100% reliant upon great weather or conditions or skies or whatever. Just go out and see what you get. And odds are, there's still times I go out and I just, whatever reason, I'm not feeling it. Maybe the light is super, dull and flat, and I just nothing catches my eye, especially here in North Texas where it can be very dismal for winter months. But it's just such a more enjoyable process now. I'm guided by openness and curiosity, and I don't have all of these additional internal pressures on myself in terms of, well, I gotta have this, I gotta have that, if it's not this, then why bother? And, I'm going to be mad and everything like that. And not surprisingly, I'm a much happier photographer too. So I think there's something to be said for being open to what comes your way and just going with things. And I think ultimately it kind of forces you to think a little bit more creatively because you're not zeroed in on just these certain things. Again, a great sunset or sunrise or foggy conditions, although I would love to have more foggy conditions here. It just has made me so much more open to other possibilities. And I think that's also where I've found my love for tree photography and woodland photography. If I had still been in that mindset of 2016 and 2017, I never would have found that. And I absolutely love that. That's kind of, a lot of people refer to me as the tree guy now. So I'm the Lightroom guy and the tree guy. But consciously shifting my mindset is what led me to that. And I sure as heck ain't giving that up.
That resonates a lot with me. It's very similar to my approach nowadays as well. And it's funny that you brought up out of Yosemite, because the conditions you described, blue skies, no clouds, that's exactly what we got. And it was actually really fun to experience Yosemite. I mean, it's February. There was no snow. You know, like
nothing you would typically want in Yosemite.
You're thinking Yosemite in winter. Oh, we're gonna have snow. Right. It's gonna be like, oh, there's zero clouds. And man, it was really fun to teach though, because we got to show people at that conference that there's more to landscape photography than depending on excellent conditions, and actually opening yourself up to receiving what nature has to give you is going to allow you to make better and more personally expressive images that are unique to you, that are interesting and different than what you typically would see on Instagram or whatever. So I really liked that experience personally.
Yeah, no, I think it was, I can't say it was eye-opening per se, but it was definitely the first time I'd been to a big destination like that, where I just never, well, other than I arrived earlier and I had that amazing sunset at Tunnel View, so I'm being a little bit of a hypocrite, but but like typically when I had gone on workshops or whatever, like I usually had pretty good conditions or whatever, or it was back far enough to where I just didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't come away with a whole lot of stuff anyways. Yosemite was one of my bucket list locations, and of course I would have loved to have been there with snowy conditions, or you know, the wonderful fog in the valley or whatever, but it was still great. And I came away with some of my favorite photos, some of my most popular photos to date. So certainly there's plenty you can do with blue skies. Now, I will say, if I can go on a related tangent, I have been thinking a lot in the last year about, and it's always kind of been in the back of my mind of, you know, I go to these beautiful places, whether it's southern Utah or Yosemite as an example or whatever, and I'm taking all these small scene shots, whether it's, well, mostly it's trees. But it's always kind of sort of bothered me that I come away from a trip or a location without anything to really show the location itself, if that makes sense. And I talked about this in my Utah ebook that I put out, but kind of looking at it as the soul of a place is those small scenes and the details or the abstracts, or you know, ice and you know, slight broader sense of the place with the grand epic vistas and everything. And an example of that, it would be Bryce Canyon when I was there just about a year ago. In March of last year, I intentionally went into that trip, wanted to use my wide angle focal lengths more and wanting to show the broader, grander vista, because part of, not even part of, a large part of what got me into photography and sharing my photography was for the sake of my mom and my family and my friends, that presumably they have no idea what Bryce Canyon looks like, or you know, Grand Teton National Park, or whatever example you want to use. And if all I come back with is a bunch of photos of trees at 300 millimeters, they may get a sense of the soul, but that tree could have been taken just about anywhere. So how do I still show the grandeur of places that are absolutely amazing to experience? And maybe the photography that comes out of that isn't quite as creative or whatever, but it still has personal meaning to me. And looking at it as how do I do that more creative type photography, but also get the photography out there that somebody like my mom, or you know, a friend that doesn't get to travel or whatever, like gives them the appreciation of the beautiful world that we live in, the variety of places and everything. Because there's a lot of my photos, whether it's here in Texas or even Yosemite or Utah or what have you, where you look at it, unless I tell you, you would never be able to guess where it was taken. So I have been thinking about that a lot the last year, especially, and going into that Utah trip last March was the first time in quote-unquote modern-day Mike's photography where I've had that consciously on my mind in terms of how do I show both sides of a place, both the grand and the more soulful side of it. So I think there's a balance there.
There is. And it's funny, too, because you think about the non-photography public, the photos that they gravitate towards liking are the ones of just blue sky, mm-hmm. you know, not fiery red, everything's on fire, you know. They actually like, you know, just a pretty calm blue sky photograph. So But it's not what we like to photograph, but I think it is important to show off some of those types of images, because I think it does help, like you say, you're telling the soul of a place, but you also want to tell the skeleton and the bones of the place as well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and honestly, like a place like Bryce Canyon, one of its most beautiful aspects is how it looks with a blue sky, because you've got the rich warm tones of the landscape. And, you know, something I've been feeling personally, and I've talked to a few people about it, is like a fantastic sunrise or sunset at Bryce Canyon is wonderful, no question. But if you've got a fantastic landscape laid out before you or in front of you, and it's really the subject that you want to show, a crazy sky detracts from that. So from a photographer's standpoint, your first inclination may be, yeah, okay, it's not epic, it's not special or what have you. But, you know, I look at it as there's still an opportunity to try to find a creative composition of a broader scene, a grander vista. And if it's a blue sky, it's a blue sky. But if it's the right location, that can act as a complement to the landscape as opposed to fighting for attention with the landscape. Because God knows there's tons of amazing sunset and sunrise photos I've looked at where, other than maybe recognizing that the landscape is there, like there's really, the first thought is, wow, look at that sky.
Right.
And then maybe with some further reflection, you appreciate the landscape itself, but not always. Sometimes the sky kind of overpowers it. So again, I don't want to say like, if there's an epic sunrise in front of me, I'm not going to shoot it. But I think there's an opportunity to recognize the value of those varying conditions.
I agree. All right, well, we got like 20 more topics, so let's move on from this one.
I told you I could talk, man.
All right, so going back to YouTube for just a minute, what plans do you have to expand your presence there? I know you've got some ideas on how to collaborate with some other people.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously the first thing is what I've already talked about with doing some of these infield videos and branching out in terms of sharing more around my experiences, which goes to showing me as an authentic person, but also just the authenticity behind my work. Like, hey, if you see one of my photos, I haven't photoshopped in a sky or a tree or, you know, whatever, because guess what? Here's the video of you know, my experiences making the photos. But from a kind of a different angle, and this is an example of something that I've been going back to the business discussion, like I've had this idea for over a year now, and I still haven't haven't implemented it, but I've got an idea. I've got a very small series on my channel called Making the Image, which is me sharing one of my images, whether it's one of my personal favorites or popular ones or whatever, and breaking it down in terms of here's why I composed it the way I did or why I cropped it the way I did in post, how I processed it, but from not from a step-by-step to-do standpoint, but more from a creative why standpoint, as a less the how and more the creative why. So here's why I dodged here. Here's why I burned here. Here's why I, you know, shifted the hue a little bit or drew down the saturation or you know, what have you, to help people understand that understand and think about the why that goes into their own work, as opposed to just worrying so much about the technical stuff, because we can all get too focused in, especially when we're starting out, on the technical, and forget about, you know, hey, there's a lot of creativity that goes into post-processing and, you know, framing the composition in the field and everything. So the idea that I want to do, and I've got a template email to start sending out to people, so hopefully in the next, I want to say, a few weeks, is start inviting guests onto the channel so that they can take one of their photos. Again, maybe it's one that I particularly love or is very popular with their audience, or it's a personal favorite of theirs, and invite them to come on and do the same thing. And whether it's showing maybe they've got, you know, test composition shots or alternate compositions that they took, and talking through why that didn't work and why they landed on the one they did for the final image, talking through their processing. The whole idea of the series I've done so far, and I've only done 3 videos, so it's not like this is a huge series I've done, but I do like the idea. But the whole idea is that processing is platform agnostic, so I should be talking about the image and my approach to it creatively, so that anybody, whether they're using what's the Capture One or, you know, whatever, like they should be able to take those thought processes and implement them within their own software of choice. So it's not about the tools you're using. Again, it's all about the creative aspect of it. Now, I did have somebody kind of challenge me on, well, if I don't know how to use the tools, then the creative aspect of that is very challenging, which is totally fair, but there's millions of other videos out there, including some of my own, teach you how to do it. So let's talk about the whys of those decisions as well. I think it's something that's not talked about a whole lot, and it's probably talked about more in like maybe, I can't even say social media, you see it discussed a lot. Maybe the best example would be the Discord group we're both in, Tristan Todd's Landscape Photographers Worldwide Discord. But I don't feel like there's a whole lot of discussion about why people chose to frame it this way or process it that way or what have you. So I think there's an opportunity there, and I think it's something that deserves to be talked about a little bit more. So again, my hope is start inviting people on like yourself or Cody Schultz I've talked to, Jeffrey Tadlock, Ben Horn, try to get people in with different viewpoints. And because it's meant to be platform agnostic, I also don't want it to be, or I guess I do want it to be style agnostic as well. So hey, if you're a heavy compositor, dude, come in and talk about it and share that story too, because I think that's a huge opportunity. Like, I've got nothing against compositing, and not to take it down that road, because I know you've talked about it plenty on your podcast, but like, there's tremendous skill and creativity that goes into it. Let's talk about it. Instead of potentially maybe sweeping it under the rug and presenting it as something authentic, let's talk about the creative aspect of that. So, you know, right. I see opportunity from it from all angles. Like, I don't want to just be a bunch of people that photograph like me coming on and talking about kind of a, you know, similar approach or whatever. So hopefully get that off the road or off the ground here shortly. It's just, man, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't have a full-time job. I do have the part-time job, but I feel like I've got less time now than when I was working full-time sometimes.
I know, so, me too, actually. It's kind of weird. I don't really get it.
I don't either, man. Like, right now, I'm, like, so focused on these Utah videos, and it's like, oh, I'm really enjoying putting them together and everything, but it's like, I got a couple more weeks of working on those, so when am I going to record other videos? It's just, yeah. So anyways, We'll just say hopefully in the next 60, 90 days I'll have some videos out. I'd like to get a bunch recorded and then just have them kind of queued up to go, but we'll see how that works out.
I'll hold you to it.
Yeah, well, then you can be my first guest.
We'll have someone else do it first, but I'll hold you to it.
Maybe I'll try to get Bree on. She's got a bubbly personality to draw people in.
There you go. All right, well, I'm going to use your favorite term. Let's shift gears a little bit. Shifting gears, yeah. It was funny, I did a podcast with Eric Bennett, and he was making fun of me for that, but anyway.
So it's not just me, that's good to know.
It's not just you. All right. So landscape photography has quickly shifted to a practice of perfectionism, with photographers chasing conditions, cloning out every last distraction from the photograph, and only posting their absolute best photographs to social media. What are your thoughts on this particular shift towards perfectionism?
I think it is something I've been guilty of, whether it be my photography or the pressure I had and the anxiety I had around my YouTube channel early on. Of, you know, of course I want to present myself professionally and as a, you know, topical authority or what have you, but I was pushing it too much towards that perfectionism side. And even, again, an example from my past with photography, we've all done it where you get back, you process a photo, and you throw it on social media, and then you wake up the next morning and you go, oh my God, like, what? Was I drunk? Like, that is awful. Or, you know, there's this huge glaring mistake in the editing or, you know, whatever it might be, and you pull it down. And so I went, like, 2019 and even probably actually definitely 2020 even, where like I went the complete opposite end of the spectrum, and it's like, okay, I'm not going to release any photo for at least a few weeks. And then I ended up being like a year 18 months before I was releasing some stuff, and I was like, I'm running out of things to post. Maybe I should actually, you know, let go of my babies a little bit, let them go out into the world. So again, like so many things, like there's always that fine line and a happy middle ground you got to find. But I do think, you know, especially nature photography, like nature ain't perfect. And yeah, there are things, especially on the edges of frames, like if there's a little twig poking in or a tuft of grass that's much brighter, you know, I might burn it down or clone it out just so it's not pulling the eye out of the frame. But you can go way too crazy with it, for sure. And to the point where you're presenting this like idealized version of nature that doesn't really exist.
Yeah, it's almost like sanitized.
Yeah, and to me that takes away a lot of the interest. Like one of the things I love about woodland photography, whether it's Simon Baxter or we were talking about Mark Littlejohn earlier, or whoever, is like embracing that chaos. It can be really hard, but it is messy. So if I were to go in and clone out every little stray twig and leaf or whatever, like unless it's really pulling my eye, like I'm just gonna leave it. And maybe I'll address it by playing with the contrast of that spot or dodging, burning, whatever, to kind of balance it so it's not quite so in your face. But like that's nature. So if I'm sitting here over the last year now almost banging this drum about authenticity in photography, and you know, I'm an authentic photographer and I'm showing my experiences and this and that, and I'm going in and doing all this cloning and, you know, content aware fill or whatever to make this perfect idealized image, like, well, I'm a huge hypocrite. And again, I don't have a huge problem with somebody that does, but at the same time, like you said, it's kind of like this sterilized, almost too perfect representation. So I think it's a dangerous game to chase. I've talked about on the Discord group, you know, I went through much of my career with this mindset of good enough never is. I think when I shared that, everyone was like, oh my gosh, what a terrible mindset to have. I never really thought about it as being like a terrible thing, but back when I was still a store manager, I was driving to work, and every day on the way to work, I would pass my old middle school. And of course, they had a little signboard out that, you know, had motivational quotes or, you know, whatever nonsense. And one morning, they had good enough never is. I was like, oh, that, you know, that's fantastic. And there's merit to it to an extent. You know, just like, it's good enough. Like, you don't want to be sloppy. But it also led to a lot of perfectionism and probably drove a lot of my employees crazy at times, too, in terms of, well, good enough never is. You know, it was one of my favorite phrases to use. I think I had it in my email signature at one point when I was a district manager. Now it's like, oh, my God, I was that guy. But like, you got to realize when something is truly good enough. Otherwise, you may never share it with the world, or you're going to kill yourself with obsessing over every little thing. And now the phrase that I really love is, kind of hear it two different ways. I don't think it's a, you know, unknown phrase, but don't let perfect be the enemy of done, or don't let perfect be the enemy of good. And I see that a ton with photographers is like, oh, well, I'm not going to share my work because it's not perfect. Or I don't think I'm going to edit this, you know, these 30 files I've got from this trip because they're not perfect compositions, or the light wasn't perfect, or whatever. That's a really, really slippery slope. And I've been on that slope, whether it was in my career or some of the perfectionism that was creeping into the photography stuff. Just, again, like so many things, you got to find the happy middle ground, but you can really easily make yourself pretty miserable with that pursuit of perfection, no matter what it is. But, you know, especially in the photography space and the creative space, like creativity also really shouldn't be perfect, probably. It should be a little messy and maybe out there sometimes. So,
yeah, when I think of some of my favorite photographers, like Alex Noriega, what makes them really good at photography, if you really were to drill it down, it's that they're very, very, very meticulous in their curation process, which is definitely crossing into that perfectionism side of things, I would say. But at the same time, I think, like you said, there's a balance to be struck in terms of being okay with a photograph, even if it's not quite perfect. And then what I like to do is I like to, as you know, I like to bounce things off of other people and say, hey, what did I miss? You know, like, how can I make these photographs better? Or which ones do you think stand out? I think that's a much healthier approach because, you know, you might make a couple of minor tweaks to an image to make it a little bit better, but it's never going to be perfect, you know?
No, it's not. And, you know, I'm the same way. As you know, you and I have both shared photos back and forth, and I've, you know, with the ebooks that I've put out, I've shared them with other people. And, you know, it's always good to get that other viewpoint and kind of forcing you to think about something a little bit differently, but also gives me the opportunity to be like, no, dude, you're wrong. Like, and there was one that you gave me feedback on from my fall trip. Like, yeah, it doesn't really, I'm like, that's one of my favorites from the entire trip. Like, I'm not taking that out. Are you crazy? So it also gives you the opportunity to stand your ground in terms of what your vision is. Like, and I think that's what people fall into a trap too with critiques, and that is like, dude, this person, it's just an opinion. Now, if it's technical based, that's one thing. But if it's more on the creative spectrum, you know, how they processed it, or, you know, this is high key versus normal, or, you know, whatever, like, that's stuff that you should be able to, quote unquote, argue, you know, for. And actually, that's one thing, you know, Heather went to art school. She's a graphic designer. And you know, one of the things that they drilled into them in school is, you know, you should be able to fight for your creativity and your art. And when I've done critiques for people, that's, you know, one of the things I tell them is like, keep in mind, this is subjective. So if you disagree with me, don't just go along with it because, you know, maybe you respect me, or, you know, you admire my work or whatever, or you just think that that's what you have to do. Like, tell me, you know, argue why I'm wrong, why you chose to do it that way. It's a great way to make you think more critically, not critically negatively, but just more critically about your own why. Again, going back to that creative why discussion around your work, your processing, and everything.
Yeah. Well, you just brought up ebooks, and I know we want to talk about ebooks, but I'm thinking maybe ebooks will make for a pretty interesting Patreon episode. So I think we'll save it for that. And what I want to do is I want to shift us over to talking about the folios that you've created. And just in the nick of time, last night, yep, I got your two really cool folios. And I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about what they are. I mean, I think you're kind of following in the model of Ben Horn a little bit in terms of what, you know, what folios are. It's, you know, it's like a small collection of images, probably taken in the same year, perhaps. Yeah. So for you, what are folios, and what do you hope to accomplish with them? And while talk, maybe I'll kind of show off some of what you sent to me.
Sure, sure. That'd be fantastic. I'd appreciate that. So yes, obviously Ben Horn has been somebody who I've admired in terms of his approach with the folios and the box sets that he did before the folios. But full disclosure, I've never bought a Ben Horn folio, ironically enough. I do have one of his prints, so I don't feel too bad about it. But there's your beautiful certificate of authenticity, the most beautiful sheet in the folio. My first hands-on experience with a folio was actually at Out of Yosemite with Charlotte Hamilton Gibb. I don't know if you had a chance to see that, but she had her new folio there, and it was on this just fantastic heavyweight textured art paper similar to what I'm using in mine. And it was just, I mean, her photography is beautiful anyways, but seeing it in that printed format in a curated selection, and hers was really a box set, it wasn't a folio, but it was just, you know, you hear all the time that the print is the true form of the photography, or of the photo. It was just stunningly beautiful from the presentation to the paper to her processing, you know, the whole bit, the compositions. Like, it almost brought me to tears, and I'm not one to get like teary-eyed over my work or somebody else's work or whatever. And so that kind of planted the seed, and obviously I was already aware of Ben at the time as well. Charlotte's box set that I saw in person and got to touch and feel was certainly a huge inspiration early on in terms of kind of getting me thinking about it. But I like Ben's approach in terms of his consistency with it. And also, one of the things that I think anybody trying to sell prints, or many people trying to sell prints, one of the things we struggle with is pricing things at a price point that makes sense, accounting for time and effort and money investment and materials and everything, where very quickly that price of a print can balloon up out of the reach of many, many people. I saw the folios as a way to provide a curated selection of what I felt was some of my best work. And it's kind of annual. I mean, I've released them annually, but they're not necessarily from just the prior year. I'm digging into my archives as well, too. But it's a way to have that nice cohesive curated presentation, but also at a lower price point to let somebody that wants to have some prints of mine get in at a more affordable price. Now, from that standpoint, like from a business standpoint, folios don't make a whole lot of sense. You know, selling them at $125, you know, at first glance, like my margin is decent on them, but you know, I just implemented free shipping for U.S. addresses now, which I wasn't doing before. So, you know, there's $10 to $20 cut out of it, depending on, you know, where it's going and shipping rates and everything. But then when I factor in the time, like to produce, I had the one folio I sent you. I already had that produced because I kind of used that to show people in person and everything. But I had to print off the second one. And I timed it, like going just about as quick as I could. And I had a couple, not technical hiccups so much as just stupid mistakes I made on a couple of the prints. But like it took me almost an hour to print the prints for that one folio. And that's not even like I didn't sign the backs of them like I would normally do. I didn't number them. And then that's not counting for the time to package them up, review them real, real carefully. Hopefully all your prints are great. I looked at them, but I didn't go over them like I would normally do for a normal person. Not that you're abnormal, but yeah, a little bit.
Thanks for that.
Hey, you know, I'm always here for making a compliment for you, buddy. But, you know, just the time of production for each folio, but the time going into preparing for it. And I've got proofing prints that I run. This isn't even all of them, but, you know, sheets where I think I had like 20 thumbnail images of proofing prints just to kind of see them all together and, you know, lay them out and what looks right in the 4x4, 4x5 format. That's another thing. I'm taking images that are, you know, in many cases, 2:3 aspect ratio, and I'm having to revisit them and crop them and see if does this work as a 4:5, because I'm printing on 8x10 sheets and I don't want to have inconsistent borders within the folio itself, because I think that would look weird. You know, I've got one image in particular, Letting Go, that it's one of my favorite images from fall of 2022. I really wanted it in the folio, but it was composed for a 2:3 aspect and it don't work a 4:5 aspect. So, you know, doing all the proofing printing ahead of time, and even when I've got everything already proofed, like part of my printing process here in studio is I'll still do a small proofing print to make sure that I'm still happy with it. You know, I learn new skills, or my eye changes a little bit over time, or I realize that, you know, how I had it proofed before, I can do it a little bit better or differently that I like better now, or whatever. So there's just so much time that goes into it, especially the first folio when I was trying to figure it all out, and the time to, you know, find the folios themselves and what to use and how I was going to do them. You know, am I going to follow Ben's lead and create little, you know, title sleeves, or go the route I ended up going with the embossed silver foil titling and everything? Just so much time. So when I factor in cost of materials and cost of time, like, I doubt I'm even breaking even on the folios thing. But I also look at it as a way for me to promote my work in a different manner besides just slapping it up on social media. It gives me an opportunity to, in full disclosure, like totally selfishly, talk about the fact that I sell prints and that I produce my own prints and everything. And I think the challenge I have is getting them into more people's hands, which is why I was so certain to get them to you. Not that you haven't seen one of my prints already, but it's just a different avenue to kind of, again, get that foot in the door from a print standpoint, offer a different, more affordable option for people. Hopefully the selections I make resonate with them. I also love producing them. Like the first one I ever printed, and I got it all packaged up in the folio, like it was just like this moment of such a great euphoric feeling, because like I'm looking at it, I was like, this looks really freaking good. And then the reality sets in, I'm actually trying to sell them.
Yeah, so I mean, I will say they're really nice. I mean, I was immediately impressed. The thickness of the paper. What, you're using Red River?
Yeah, and the scary part is that paper is unavailable right now. So, yeah, the manufacturer that provides the paper stock for that Palo Duro etching stopped production temporarily last year, and they're just ramping back up. But it was originally like, oh, it's going to be out of stock until 2023. Then it was February. I just went on today, actually. And now it's March, and like they have none. And I'm looking at maybe a box and a half of 8x10 sheets, so enough to produce maybe 6 to 7 folios right now. So that's a little terrifying. If this does get resolved soon, I may have to find an alternative paper that I like just as much, because I love that paper. As you said, it's got a really nice heavy feel to it, and that subtle texture that isn't distracting from the image, and I absolutely love it. And of course, it's the one paper that they're having problems stocking. So yeah, that was a long-winded answer to your question. Yes, it's Red River.
Red River. And I really like the text that you put at the very bottom of the title of the photograph. I think that looks really good. Let's maybe talk a little bit about kind of the nitty-gritty, because I know from our conversations you're a spreadsheet guy like I am. So you've got how many sheets in each folio?
Let's see. There's the 10 prints.
10.
Certificate of authenticity, and then for a normal buying collector, it would also have a thank you sheet with my signature and just a little personalized note, and then a QR code. I also do kind of a, not behind the scenes video, but I have videos for each folio edition for people that have bought them where they can click that QR code or type in the URL, and it takes them to a video where I talk about each image and why I selected it, what I like about it, maybe how I had to tweak it for the folio, so on and so forth. So there would be a 12th sheet in there for that. So that's 12 sheets. Each sheet with cost of ink is $4 or $5, I want to say, which doesn't sound like much until you factor in that there's 12 sheets. So right there, you're at, $48. Mm-hmm. Not counting the cost of the folio itself, not counting the cost of the die for the folio, not counting the cost of the shipping materials and everything there, or the time aspect, which it's always nice to get paid for your time. So.
And you've got these really nice embossed kind of holders, you know, which are really cool.
Yeah, I really like the way that turned out. And it's a lot easier than printing and gluing sleeves for every single one.
So not accounting for your time and probably including shipping, you're probably looking at like $75.
With shipping, it's probably 60-ish once you factor in shipping for U.S. since that's included now, which was big reason why I was really hesitant to start offering free shipping, but it's kind of the norm. It's kind of expected these days, I think. So I decided I should probably do it. Why not?
And how did you land on the price?
That was totally just copying Ben. I've got the whole tiered pricing and the whole bit, which I've even thought about that. It's like, you know, tier one is $125, then I think it goes up to $135, and it maxes out at this is terrible, I should know this, but I think it's $170. Like, is it really even worth doing the tiers? Of course, part of the goal, these are limited edition anyways, I only produce 50 of them, and part of the goal with the tiers is to encourage people to, you know, get in sooner than waiting, but I don't really think it makes much of a difference. Now, obviously, my margins would increase as I hit each tier, which would certainly be nice, but, you know, with my current sales volume of it, and again, going back to early on, like full transparency, like they've done about as well as I expected. Like, I didn't expect these to catch on fire. And part of the reason I've done them the way I had, like, everybody does a calendar, right? Or, you know, a lot of people do calendars. Of course, the risk we all know with calendars is if you don't sell out, they have an expiration date. So, you know, I produce 50 of these things. If it takes me 5 years to sell through volume one, I'll be a little sad. But they're still viable products. They're still viable offerings. It's not like, oh, well, I just got to, you know, throw the folios out and write off that cost that I invested up front. So, but yeah, sales have been a slow grind, but I figured they would. I am thinking maybe for the next one, I've been releasing these typically around the holiday season. So kind of start this one, I started promoting, I think, back in late September, early October, and then I started shipping them December 1st. But I may push to spring for the next volume because I just, you know, as again, we all know, like everybody's just inundated with emails and sales. And, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to buy a folio from Michael Rung, or are you going to buy your spouse a gift or your kids' gifts or whatever? So, thinking like maybe, especially again with my smaller audience and I don't have the weight behind my name like a Ben Horn does or whatever, but, you know, so would it make more sense to do like an April release or something? Plus, it would let me make sure I get all my prior year photos edited and ready to go if I wanted to include them. So I'm mulling over, like, maybe the next one will be like a 17-month gap between folios instead of doing it in the holiday season again. See if maybe that helps the sales a little bit. But, yeah, we'll see. Again, like, they don't have an expiration date, so... You know, certainly I'd love them to take off a little bit sooner, but it is what it is. I'll wait it out. I'll go.
Yeah,
with the
I mean, it's interesting, right? Because I feel like that's where Ben has an advantage because he has this huge following on YouTube, and those people, I mean, he's an interesting business model, right? Like, he has a YouTube channel that's primarily geared towards other photographers, probably, that are watching and, you know, following him along on his adventures. And he's selling these folios mostly to other photographers, which I think is, you know, that's a fairly atypical business model when it comes to selling prints or physical goods. Usually your audience that you're tailored towards on YouTube is for photography is usually on a teaching perspective. So I think that's where your shift towards doing more in the field type stuff is going to cultivate a different audience that probably will have a more appreciation for what you've produced here. Because I mean, I can tell you right now, these folios are way more awesome than even some of the books I've bought before. So I mean, they're really good.
Well, I want to say I don't know about that, but thank you.
No, they're not. They're really nice.
Well, I mean, and let's talk about the book aspect of it too. Is like, I'm selling a folio. Like, the cheapest you can get one of my folios is $125. With, you know, if you get on the first tier, I just got, you know, William Neal's. I haven't even had a chance to crack it open yet. I just unboxed it today, but I've got William Neal's new book, which, if memory serves me, was 90, and I've got, you know, a couple hundred pages and, you know, who knows how many dozens of photos included. So it is an interesting value proposition from, you know, okay, if I'm a potential buyer, I can buy a Michael Rung folio or a Ben Horn folio or a Jack Lodge over in the UK. So he used to, I don't know if he still does, but anyways, box sets, whatever. I can buy one of those for quite likely more than a book and technically get less quote unquote content. Now, obviously, a book, a very personal project for the photographer that produced the book, no question about it. I don't want to come across as I'm taking away from that, but I would like to think it's not the same as if I had a collection of prints from William that he had printed himself and proofed himself and signed and touched, and I knew that he was personally the one that crafted it. And again, that gets into the whole like fine art, you know, hoity-toity terminology or whatever, but right. I look at the folio as much more of a fine art geared offering than if I were to go out and do a book. And let's be realistic, I am nowhere even close to it being any way, shape, or form logical or sensical to produce a book. Like, that would be insane for me to do right now. Certainly I would love to do it someday, but it's just, yeah, you got to have a huge audience, as you've talked with Eric and others, to even dream about making that a viable thing. So, you know, I think it potentially, and I'm just speculating, like, why have I not sold more folios? Well, I released a folio at the same time that a lot of buzz was going on around other books, you know, Bill's book, and I think Eric had just announced pre-orders for his book, and some others had. So, you know, I'm from a price standpoint, is it because somebody's looking at $125 for a folio versus $90 for a book, not accounting for the shipping on the book, which can be quite high. But at first glance, when you're just comparing things on a website, and again, this is the challenge of print sales in general, like if you're not there with the person and showing them the actual product, like you're able to now with the two folios I sent you, how do you convey why that folio is worth $125 versus a book for $75 or $90 or, you know, what have you? So I think that's a challenge too that I don't really know how to overcome, other than, again, quite frankly, coming on here and shilling it to your audience and things like that, right? Because like, until I get other people to see it and talk it up, which thankfully the people that have bought them so far have been, you know, very, very generous with their feedback and their praise of them. But that's a very small subset of people that have bought them. So, you know, odds are most people have no idea that I even offer these, or, you know, they've seen it mentioned in my emails, and I'm trying to find that balance between beating people over the head with talking about it and, you know, please buy my folio, and they unsubscribe because they're sick of hearing about it and that whole bit. So I think there's a lot of unique challenges that go into it. But at the end of the day, like the way I produce them, quote unquote, to use a retailer production term, just in time. So unless I'm going into pre-orders and I know I've got, you know, X number of pre-orders, then I'll produce those all ahead of time and have them ready to go. But, you know, if somebody were to order one today, then tonight or tomorrow I would produce the prints and the whole thing. So I'm minimizing my upfront cost to an extent as well. So
right.
My upfront cost really is the folios themselves and the time that I put into make the selections, do the proofing prints, and you know, all that. And obviously volume two was a lot easier than volume one because I'm just going with the same approach that I had to spend all the time before volume one figuring out. I don't have to do that this time. So it's not like I've gone out and spent $10,000 or something out of my own pocket, and you know, now I'm sitting here sweating because I'm not getting that ROI. Yeah, it's I think it's a good balance of minimizing my financial risk while also hopefully producing something that over time, again, like the word gets out there and people see it, more people see it, and that word of mouth spreads and people realize its own value proposition compared to the other options out there, even my own. Like, well, I can buy an 11x14 print, or I can buy a folio, like, you know, which is the right option for me. So yeah, there's a ton of factors that go into it, and I certainly don't have all the answers. And I only know, like, Ben, is his audience mainly photographers? I don't know. You know, does he have a different audience of folio customers versus YouTube? But yeah, I mean, I really don't know. But you know, from his standpoint, he's been doing the YouTube videos for, what, over 10 years now, I think? If not coming up on 15. Like, I started YouTube during the pandemic, so well, there's a big difference there. So,
well,
it's all part of the process, I think.
And so did, like, 500 other photographers, you know what I mean? So that's the other thing, too, is, like, how do you find a way to differentiate yourself and stand out in a very crowded field of people? I mean, I think something like a folio would do really well at, like, an art show where you could have a booth and you're like, oh yeah, I have these prints, but I also have these really cool folios if you don't want to take home a print. I mean, that would be so much easier of a transaction for so many people. Like, oh, I'd rather just take that and give that as a gift to somebody or something like that. So
yeah, I do think it's a very tactile experience.
It is, for sure.
It's very hard to convey, and even in a video, let alone, you know, static images on a website or whatever.
Right.
Which is the challenge with prints in general, but especially I think something like a folio, it's even more so.
For sure. Well, I have one more topic that is very, very, very related to what we were just talking about, because I think you fall into a zone where I feel like it affects a lot of people that are at a similar crossroads in their career point in photography as you are. And essentially, what I've noticed is that there's a lot of photographers looking to kind of break into full-time photography, and oftentimes they are hyper-focused on strategies for growth, you know, YouTube videos, ebooks, newsletters, social media. But what I often find is that a lot of these photographers aren't spending the adequate time to produce high quality work that differentiates them, or that gives them name recognition, or that helps them improve their photography in general. I'm curious, for you, how do you find a balance between those two very different activities that are both needed to make it in photography today?
Yeah, that's a loaded question in many ways. You know, I look at it, I probably am more on the spectrum, again, referring to Ben Horn. Like, I really love Ben's approach to his photography, the business side of it. Like, I don't agree with everything he does and some of the things I think he leaves on the table from a business standpoint, but that's his choice. Like, I have tremendous admiration for the way he's gone about it and the way he kind of sticks to his guns with that. But from his approach to photography in general, as anybody that follows Ben knows, like, he really only does 4, maybe 5 trips a year, and he doesn't photograph at all otherwise. He doesn't photograph locally. It's, you know, Death Valley, Zion, Southern Utah, wherever else I'm forgetting right now. But, you know, many, many people, and again, you and I have talked about this, like, well, you really need to shoot more and, you know, get more under your belt, build your portfolio, et cetera, et cetera. Now, large format 8x10 is very, very different from going out with my Canon R5 and a memory card. But as much as I would like to do more trips, and like last year, as an example, I had to cancel some trips for various reasons, through my own health and the health and eventual loss of our dog and just, you know, whatever. But I'm probably more on the Ben Horn side of that shooting frequency spectrum, and partly because, for whatever reason, you know, out of my control or whatever, time is limited or has been limited, but also, like, it keeps the fire alive. And Ben was just talking with Cody on their podcast, Creative Banter, recently about this. Like, Ben feels like he's never suffered from burnout or even come close to burnout because of the fact that he goes multiple months between trips, and you know, the trips are for photography, and when he's home, he's home, and you know, he's still working on the business side of things, but it's not eat, drink, sleep, live photography 24/7, 7 days a week. For me, I kind of feel similarly. I would prefer to shoot more often than I am, and especially from a trip standpoint, and probably more often than Ben, but I'm pretty content going months between picking up the camera. I haven't gone out and shot anything since my last fall video from Texas that I recorded, and that was, I think, December 7th or 10th, so now we're 2 months on from that. And but at the same time, like, I've got a trip coming up at the end of this month to California, and like, I've got that itch. I've got, like, I've got that excitement of, oh my God, I am ready to get out in the field with the camera. Whereas even with, I just, you know, I only went out 3 times locally for the fall colors here this year, but like, getting up that last morning, it's like, you know, going back to the same place, and part of it is like, my opportunities here locally in Texas are limited. It's North Texas, there's not a whole lot, but I enjoy having those bigger gaps because it keeps the excitement and the passion and anticipation kind of stoked in the background. And then when I do have something coming up, I'm really, really amped for it, and I go into it usually full of energy and excitement and the whole bit. So I think there is, again, like, I feel like I'm a broken record with this, but there's that middle ground, and it's going to vary for everybody. Just like we had a recent conversation on Discord of, like, I kind of get burned out on a trip after 6 or 7 days. Other people can go out in the field for 2-3 weeks and still feel energized and excited. You have to find what works for you. And, you know, I think from my standpoint, if I went out for 2 weeks, I'd probably have to adapt my approach a little bit. And one of the things I don't do is, like, build in a whole lot of leisurely time when I'm in the field. If I were doing a longer trip, I'd probably have to break it up a little bit and take some days to just lounge about or you know, do touristy things or whatever. Because, like, when I'm out with the camera and in the field, like, I'm constantly on. I'm, you know, if I'm driving somewhere, I'm probably like any photographer, but, you know, you're scanning for compositions along the road, and I'll pull over, do U-turns, and go grab the shots. So I don't give myself a lot of downtime. That's what works for me, though. I feel pretty productive at a high quality in a relatively truncated window. Somebody else might be a little bit more leisurely about it, but they can go those 3 weeks and never lose their excitement for it. As far as, like, building a portfolio, I think that's tough too, because it slides into the whole pressures of social media versus what do you really need to do to expand your skills, and are you doing it for the right reasons? I know where you're getting at is, like, by shooting more and traveling more or whatever, like, you're going to be practicing the craft more, and through that, just by natural methods, you're going to be improving. But if you're doing it because you just want hot new content to post on social media and everything, then that's probably not going to have the same outcome for you long term in terms of progression. I don't know if that's really answering your question or the concerns, but...
No, it is. I mean, I feel like one of the things I often see missing for people who are wanting to make that transition is a lack of intention. I feel like if your intention is to, like, let's just say, for example, that you want to become really well known for tree photography, and so, like, all of your trips then ideally should involve you going to a place where you know you're going to get some interesting tree photos, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whereas I think what you're talking about, the other end of that, is where people just go willy-nilly all over the place, and they're just collecting images and they're slapping them on social media, which is fine if that's what you want to do. But I think if you want to make a business out of this, then it requires a little bit more focus. And I think it is a very difficult balance. And I think if it works for you to have those long gaps in between, I think that's cool. But I also sometimes wonder if that hinders you a little bit in terms of name recognition, or, you know, having more, just a larger body of work that helps propel you in your photography career. That's kind of what I was getting at.
Yeah, and I certainly look at my body of work, and, you know, sometimes it feels very daunting when you look at somebody that's been doing it for 10 years at a high level. Like, I've been doing it 10 years, but certainly not at a high level when I first started out. And it's like, man, you know, I don't have the variety and the depth and the breadth and the whole thing. You know, part of that is just, it's going to come naturally with time. I do think by shooting more variety and more frequently, I think it gives you the opportunity to have a more highly curated collection of work to offer for prints or share on social media. Then you were talking about Alex Noriega and Eric Bennett. Like, they are quote-unquote perfectionists in terms of their curation. Like, I'm only going to put out the best work. Well, if that's the case, then you got to be out there working a lot to make sure you've got a quantity to have that kind of quote-unquote name recognition or whatever. On the flip side, like, I've heard somebody in the past say, like, well, I want every one of my photos that I share to be better than anything I've done before. And I think that's just a wildly unrealistic bar to set for yourself. And I think that's a great way to probably burn yourself out, too. So, again, I'll go back to it. Like, you've got to find that middle ground of what works best for you while helping you gain the recognition and the awareness in, you know, an audience's viewpoint over time to, you know, ideally help you grow a successful business. But I think it's something you've got to be pretty cautious about too. Like, looking at my portfolio of work, very tree-centric, but I've got other things mixed in. I'd like to have more variety mixed in, but at the same time, like, I really love the woodland stuff. On the flip side, I'm also realistic enough to know that odds are, like, I'm probably going to sell that print of the Grand Tetons versus that print of some random tree in Fort Worth, Texas. Like, so, you know, it's having that piece too. And that kind of goes back, I think, also to, like, why I got into photography. Like, sharing beautiful views and grand vistas and that, like, that's what I want to share with, again, my mom and family and friends. But that's also more likely what's going to print, or not print, but sell or you know, have more interest. I guarantee you nobody's going on Google and like, photography prints of Fort Worth trees. Like, that ain't going to happen. So
you could rank number one for that one, Michael.
I'm sure I could. So that's going down a slippery slope too of like, when do you stop shooting for yourself and start shooting for commercial purposes, which you've had plenty of discussions on the podcast about. I think right now I'm at a good balance of, I'm enjoying both sides of that coin for the reasons I spoke about earlier, but I'd also be lying, like, I'm going to California at the end of the month. I've got an opportunity to shoot in Death Valley. I ain't real jazzed about that because I don't, maybe it's ignorance, but like, I don't think Death Valley's got a ton of trees, at least not the parts I've been in. So much of my photography is rooted around that, but it'd be a great opportunity to stretch myself and challenge myself to, you know, seek out some other creative avenues. So there's that aspect of it too. There's, yeah, that's where my mind goes. It's just like, well, what about this? But also you could come out of it with something new that you love, but also Yosemite's 5-6 hours away. So there's that. So,
well, I think you're going to have a good time in Death Valley because it is a place, in my opinion, that rewards people who like to be more reactive. So I think you'll like it a lot, actually.
Yeah, I've been there in 2019, but I never saw it during daylight. So I was
a trip I
did with a friend that was mostly astro-focused, and I've got like 3 photos that I'm actually happy with from it. But I'd love to see it during the day more.
Yeah. Well, let's leave it at that, and we'll just have one more question. Who do you recommend for the podcast? Who are some people that we should try to get on the show?
So Jack Lodge, I think I mentioned him earlier. I've got a little box set of his. I don't know if he still offers them, but he's based out of the UK. I look at Jack. He's got some absolutely beautiful work, and he's really, I guess, somebody that kind of manages to find the epic conditions. I've actually joked with him. It's like, you know, some people, it just seems like they show up and a rainbow appears. That's right. Kind of how it is with Jack. It's like he's a Disney princess of amazing conditions, like puts his arms out and it all just appears. But he's got some really beautiful work. And one of the things I like about him too is, and again, I've chatted with him in, you know, instant messages and Instagram. So I hardly know him, but my impression is when I first came upon him, he was at a stage further than where I'm at now, but he was very much in the process of building his photography presence and you know, business and so forth. And since I've been following him, he has since gone full time, but he leads workshops. He from what it seems, he sells a good number of prints. He's very passionate about doing his own printing. He actually just got the same printer I've got with the Canon 2100. So it's been fun watching him dive into that. But really, really like his work. The little bit I have interacted with him, he seems like a good guy. But also from like what I want to do, it feels like he's doing it. So I have a great admiration and maybe a little bit of jealousy in terms of that. But I think he'd be really interesting to come on to talk about kind of his journey as well. I've got another Jack that I had listed, Jack Crone. He's based out of Tacoma, Washington. I feel like he's got a background that I am forgetting about right now that's not necessarily photography related, but I may be thinking about something else. But he's got a relatively small following, at least on Instagram. But he just really has some brilliant work, mostly around small scenes and abstracts, but really, really like his work. I've chatted with him quite a bit, and he's been a very gracious supporter of mine just through positive comments and some contributions and things like that. But really, really love his work. And it's something, you know, I shoot a lot of small scenes, but it's like small woodland scenes and stuff like that. His type of work, as with like a Sierra Merino, like I don't seem to have that eye for that kind of stuff. And I really admire somebody that can so consistently put together a collection of work in that frame that is so good. Shanda Aiken, we had talked about her. Like, I know she was on Bree's podcast, Wild Women Photography, which was a great interview. But I feel like I don't know a whole lot about Shanda. I know you wrote the foreword for her Beauty of Durango book. She doesn't have a huge amount of photos shared on her Instagram. I don't know if she keeps it curated or what have you, but she's got some really, really beautiful work. Obviously, she went through the process of producing a book and releasing it, so I think that'd be an opportunity to talk to somebody that maybe doesn't have as big as a following as what you would typically see from like a William Neal putting out a book or something like that. But partly, and really the rest of these people to an extent, like I just want to know more about them. Like, I'm aware of them. I admire their work. The little bit I've picked up, I admire the person, but let's just find out a little bit more. So Shanda's
definitely one of them. So these recommendations are purely selfish for you then?
Of course, of course. Natalie Oberg. So she's based out of Cyprus right now. She's a large format black and white photographer. Really, she's got some beautiful dramatic work, but also she's got some very ethereal high key work. Bold yet subtle is kind of the phrase I wrote down with her work. Again, just somebody, I had featured her on one of the weekly features that I've been helping with on the Landscape Photography Discord. Just again, I'd like to know more about her, her process, her background, hear her talk about her work in more in depth than what I was able to find online when I was writing up the feature. And the last one is another throwback to the Discord channel, Jeffrey Tadlock. I feel like I know the guy, even though I've never met him. I'll be meeting him at the end of the month, actually, in California. Does a lot of work in Ohio at Hocking Hills. He's very active on the Discord channel. He does a lot of video. He's got a ton of stuff over on his YouTube channel. So again, I feel like he and I are kind of in similar stages right now. I think he's still working full-time, if I remember correctly. But he's hustling, man. He's traveling and going out and creating the videos. And he does a lot more of the infield stuff and some gear stuff and everything like that. But again, at least to me, selfishly, right, it'd be an interesting viewpoint for other people, too, if somebody that's in a similar position in terms of starting out their journey and where they want to go and how they envision themselves getting there, so on and so forth. So I think Jeffrey would be a good guy to have on, too. Plus, he's got good work, so why not?
Yeah, and I like all the interactions I've had with him on Discord have been very positive.
Yeah, he seems like a great guy. Maybe I'll meet him in California and he's a total jerk, but no, I don't think so.
I don't think so.
That's for his benefit. I'm sure he'll listen to this.
All right, Michael. Well, this has been fun, and thanks again for sending over these folios.
Yeah, glad you like them.
Where can people learn more about you and your photography?
So, of course, social media, but given our conversation about that, michaelrungphotography.com. I've got my blog on there. You can find your way to my YouTube channel from there. All my print offerings, the folios are all on there. I've got free downloads, whether it's the ebooks that we're going to talk about for the bonus episode or what have you. So that would be your best starting point, and then kind of go from there. But certainly give me a subscribe on YouTube if you're into that. Follow me on Instagram, and if I'm not following you already, I'll follow you back. I'm always looking to meet new people and build relationships in this lonely world of full-time photography working by myself. So.
All right. Well, thanks again, man.
Yep. Thanks, man.
Well, thank you to Michael for the awesome chat. I appreciate your honesty, vulnerability, and authenticity as it relates to your pursuit of photography and how open you are regarding the challenges that we face as full-time creators. Michael has been a supporter of the podcast on Patreon for a very long time at the $20 per month level, which I think is incredibly generous of him given all of the challenges he's faced with unemployment and monetization of his photography. Creators like Michael and I depend on the generosity of the great folks that listen to this show. As you're probably tired of me talking about, one of my main goals is to grow the size of my Patreon subscribers, and I'm sure Michael would love to sell some of his print folios. First, I would encourage you to go support Michael by purchasing one of his folios. Again, I think they are really high quality, some of the best prints I have seen in my life. Really, really good stuff. Second, I would love for you guys to join in on Patreon. I've been trying to find some ways to incentivize people to join on Patreon, and I finally came up with something that you might like. Between now and the end of July 2024, I will be offering a copy of the Natural Landscape Photography Awards Year 2 book, which is awesome. It's full of amazing, amazing, amazing photography. Just an incredible body of work. Totally filled with inspiration. I will be offering a copy of that book to anyone who joins in by supporting the podcast on Patreon at the $10 per month level or higher using the annual payment option. And that's an important piece. Please pay for a full year if you'd like a copy of the book. This, of course, accomplishes several goals for me, but hopefully you'll see it as a win-win. If you've already supported the podcast at this level in the past year, hit me up and I'll be happy to also send you a copy of the book as well. Now, for those who are wondering, for any of these books that I'll be sending out, I will be taking some of my own money and paying the Natural Landscape Photography Awards for the copies of those books. So it is coming out of my pocket, but I want to give people some incentives to join us on Patreon. To join in, head on over to patreon.com/fstop and listen, or find a link in the show notes. Okay, that's all for now. Thanks for stopping in, collaborating with us, and listening. See you next week.